Sequestration cuts, immigration, drones, gun legislation. This hour, an update on what's going on in Washington from two of Iowa's congressmen. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we continue our discussions with Iowa's elected representatives in Washington. In the first half hour, a conversation with Congressman Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District. Then in the second half hour, we'll be joined live by Congressman Bruce Braley of the 1st District. There's time enough before that for you to support Iowa Public Radio with your pledge of support at iowapublicradio.org or 1-800-971-8815. The news is next. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Recently, we've been checking in with Iowa's congressmen and senators at the start of the new Congress. And in this part of our program, we're joined by Congressman Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District in the southeast part of the state, including the cities of Iowa City, Davenport, Muscatine, Clinton, Burlington, and Fort Madison. Congressman Loebsack, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks, Ben. It's always good to be on. I appreciate it.
We want to talk about a number of things in the next 15 minutes or so. Last week, let's start with this. You parted ways with most of your Democratic colleagues. You voted for a Republican spending bill that will fund the government through the end of September. And this legislation grants the Pentagon, the Department of Veterans Affairs, greater flexibility in implementing their share of these short-term spending cuts. The bill, 267 to 151, is what it passes. And you joined 52 other Democrats crossing the aisle to vote for this measure. Why?
A lot of reasons. First of all, what I'm hearing from folks throughout my district, and I know we're hearing it from people around the country, is that we've got to work together to try to move this country forward, move my district forward, move Iowa forward. You know, I was just with a group of Democrats over in central Iowa a couple weeks ago, and this is a Democratic group, and they actually wanted me to talk about bridging the partisan divide. That's one of the reasons I voted for it. I think we've got to move this along. We've got to do everything we can to, you know, prevent a government shutdown, certainly. I have a little bit of confidence, at least, that the Senate's going to offer something better, and then we'll have a conference committee if that's the case. Certainly, I don't like everything that was in that bill by any means, but I think it's important to give as many departments as possible as much flexibility as possible. One of the things with the Department of Defense that's important has to do with the furlough situation, and of course, I have the Rock Island Arsenal in my district now, and there are a lot of folks working there who are going to be furloughed, it looks like, but if we can prevent that from happening or provide some flexibility along those lines, I think that's a really good thing.
Mm-hmm. Most House Democrats, including your colleague here in Iowa, Congressman Bruce Braley of Iowa's 1st, didn't vote for this. I think they said it didn't give the domestic programs the same kind of flexibility in dealing with these automatic budget cuts, known as the sequestration, that are now given to the Pentagon in this bill.
That's exactly right, and that's an unfortunate part of this particular continuing resolution. And I'm confident that you know, there's going to be some movement in that direction on the Senate side. This isn't the end of the story by any means. Again, I think it's important that we keep moving things along. I don't want to see the sequestration at all. The sequestration was a wrong thing to do. It's an unthinking across the board cut.
You did not vote for it, if I understand.
No. I have voted against the Budget Control Act back in 2011, which established a procedure by which this sequestration may go into effect. We still have some opportunity to reverse it, but as every day goes by, I think we have less opportunity to do that. As far as I'm concerned, members of Congress get paid to make the hard decisions, not to make easy, unthinking decisions, and that's what sequestration is.
Mm-hmm. You've, in fact, introduced legislation that would cut members of Congress's pay by 10%. It also repeals the automatic pay increases that currently take place. Tell us the thinking behind that bill.
Well, the thinking behind that bill is that really for too long, members of Congress, I think, have not had a personal stake in reducing the budget deficit or trying to send a signal, at least, to folks who've been struggling in this economy that we get it. And I think, you know, if you look at, obviously, at the polling, Congress doesn't do very well. I think most people, and probably rightly so, think that members of Congress are disconnected often from their constituents. And this is an attempt to say, look, you know, I get it, and I have some sense of what folks are going through, and I'm willing to put some skin in the game in that sense. So I think that 10% pay cut makes sense. I think it repealing the automatic pay increases makes a lot of sense. It just doesn't seem rational to me that Congress should get an automatic pay increase based on the cost of living unless Congress votes against it. It should be the other way around.
Mm-hmm. But will it have any real effect on members of Congress, or would you say it's more symbolic and a bit of a satisfying punishment to members of Congress? You mentioned the poll numbers, that a satisfying punishment given the frustration we have with Congress.
Even if it's symbolic, I think it's a step in the right direction. You know, clearly, I have a bigger concern here, too. It's not just the fact that Congress is unpopular. I have a real concern that if this goes too far, that the very legitimacy of our democracy is going to be questioned by a lot of folks in our society. And I really worry about that. I really worry we're going to go back to the time, for example, during Watergate in Vietnam. And that's not a good situation for democracy as a whole. So one can say it's just symbolic. Like it's not that big of a deal, but at least it's a step in the right direction, I believe, and it'll save about $150 million over 10 years. Again, that's a drop in the bucket, if you will, compared to what our deficit is on an annual basis. But again, I think it's a step in the right direction. It's a common sense proposal, and I think it does send a signal to the American people that Congress has some part to play in all of this.
Any chance that would make it through Congress?
It's hard to know at this point. What I can tell you is that one of the local TV stations here in the area put it up on their Facebook page, and it had about 190,000 likes. I'm telling as many colleagues of mine in the House of Representatives as possible about that to give them some sense of just what the American people think about this.
Mm-hmm. If we could, let's change Congressman Loebsack to the subject of immigration. On Sunday on CNN, Representative Kevin McCarthy, a Republican in California, he's the highest-ranking Republican in the House, said there's enough support in the House to pass comprehensive immigration reform. Now, McCarthy didn't go into details. A key demand of your party, the Democrats, is a pathway to citizenship for undocumented workers. Do you think the GOP will go along with that?
I don't know. That's a great question, but I am very heartened at the progress that is being made on a bipartisan basis on immigration in both the House and the Senate. I think there's a real impetus here, partly as a result of the last election nationally, but partly because people understand that there's just too much out there at stake not to move forward on this. You know, we've got to have border control, and I've voted to beef up border control. We've got to do everything we can to deal effectively and productively with those 11 or 12 million folks who are here and undocumented. I think we've got to crack down on employers who knowingly employ undocumented workers. And look, I voted for e-verification on that front a number of times. So there are a lot of different aspects to this. But I guess I'm heartened more than anything else that there are groups in both houses of Congress that are moving forward on the issue.
Would you characterize it that the Democrats have kept their position more or less after this past election, and it's the Republicans, many Republicans, that have moved toward the Democrats, toward the middle?
Well, you know me, Ben, I don't like to score sort of these kinds of things politically. I think what's important is that we move forward on this thing and that Republicans and Democrats, as has been the case in recent weeks and recent months, come together and try to find some kind of common ground on this thing. And again, I just think the American people are kind of tired of thinking about who's winning and who's losing, you know, in terms of the political parties. I know that, a lot of folks like to think in those terms, but I think it's important that we just move forward on this thing, no matter, you know, sort of who gives, who doesn't give, that kind of thing.
If you've just joined us, Congressman Dave Loebsack, my guest for this part of River to River, Congressman Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District. On the immigration, I understand that all sides have agreed that the Senate will move first on the immigration reform. If the bill passes there, it will head to the House. Any idea of the time frame?
No, not at this point. But again, I'm to be perfectly blunt about this, I am really quite surprised this thing is moving along as quickly as it is, and that there's as much support out there on a bipartisan basis for moving this thing along. I think all parties have an interest in getting it off the political table as much as anything, too. But it's the right thing to continue to move forward.
Drones have become a huge part of our national conversation, Congressman. Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky launched a nationwide conversation last week. I was on the soccer fields at the Iowa State Indoor Championship, and certainly a lot of people talking about the drones because of that, partly because of that 13-hour filibuster of the president's nominee to head to the CIA, John Brennan. He vowed to keep talking until the White House clarified whether it has authority to kill U.S. citizens on American soil with drones. Administration lawyers said in all but the most extreme cases, the answer is no.
Right.
Filibuster was ended. Now, how do you see this issue? Drones will be a part of our future, not just military, but in the civilian sector. What are your major concerns?
Well, I do have the same concerns that a number of folks have on both sides of the aisle in terms of our civil liberties here in America and American citizens, whether it's on our own soil or on foreign soil. I think we've got to find a balance when it comes to the use of drones or any other military arsenal, part of our military arsenal for that matter. Certainly when it comes to domestic issues, when it comes to the domestic side of this, we've got to have a much clearer policy kind of laying out the limits. And I think that while I was certainly happy that the Attorney General said what he said, I think that Senator Paul played a crucial role. I'm not sure that the filibuster is the best way to go about this, but nonetheless drawing attention to what is an issue that has concern across the aisle, I think,
and
on the part of both Republicans and Democrats.
Excuse me, you're hearing from your constituents on this issue?
I am hearing some, of course, and you know, clearly overseas when it comes to taking care of this country and making sure that we protect our interests abroad. We do have to think about all the different aspects, as I said, of our arsenal, too, but making sure that we have a clear policy abroad, especially when it comes to American citizens and any targeting of American citizens. But as a member of the Armed Services Committee, this is something, of course, that interests me. But as somebody who also is very concerned about defending our interests abroad and someone who has two children in the Marine Corps, you know, who've gone abroad to carry out our mission abroad, this is something that, you know, is of interest to me. But we've got to just do a better job, I think, in terms of clarifying the policies on these issues.
Also, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, you know that by 2014, I believe, the Air Force plans to establish drone military operations based in Des Moines. These are the pilots with the 132nd Fighter Wing of the Iowa Air National Guard operating unmanned aircraft from a cockpit on the ground out of harm's way. They'll be in Des Moines at the Des Moines International Airport. They will be gathering information also in places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, also engaging the enemy, dropping bombs potentially?
That's my understanding. I have not seen in its entirety what that mission is going to entail. Of course, I preferred to keep the F-16s there myself, and I fought like heck to try to do that. It looks as though they're going to lose about 30 or 35 jobs in the end, which is much better than it was going to be. It was going to be a few hundred jobs at least. The exact nature of the mission is yet to be defined, and there'll be another mission as well. Folks will be able to stay on and, of course, keep their jobs there, and I think that's very important. But moving forward, keep in mind that when we talk about drones, some of them have a military mission. Some of them have a reconnaissance intelligence gathering mission, as you mentioned. So there are a variety of different missions when we talk about drones and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Let's finally, if we could, Congressman Lobsack, talk about gun legislation. Since that horrible elementary school shooting in Newtown, you've been speaking with constituents, I understand, and gathering opinion on possible gun legislation. What are you hearing and what conclusions are you coming to about the type of legislation that you would support and that might be able to get through Congress to decrease gun violence?
Well, whatever we do, it has to be common sense. It has to be effective. Clearly, there are some things that are going to be more effective than others. I think that one of the things that we can all agree on, and these are folks across the spectrum, no matter what one may think about gun safety and how to achieve gun safety, and that's dealing with our mental health system. You know, we've seen a lot of cutbacks at the state level, at the national level, in terms of access to mental health providers. This is something that folks in schools have talked to me about, in law enforcement, in the mental health community. I've talked to dozens of folks, not only since Sandy Hook, but prior to that as well. We've got to be able to do a better job of screening folks who have potential mental health issues, who might be a threat to our community, but keeping in mind that those who struggle with mental illness are overwhelmingly, of course, not a threat to our community, but we have to be able to do what we can at schools and within our community to identify those who might be a potential threat, and that's going to take more resources, and that access is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we have to go, your view on the support for universal background checks, does it have your support?
Oh, definitely. I think that's a no-brainer. Over 90% of the American people think that makes a lot of sense. The overwhelming majority of National Rifle Association members think that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, Congressman Loebsack, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today. Congressman Dave Loebsack of Iowa's 2nd District, we appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Ben, as always, and I really appreciate it.
Coming up in just a moment after the break, Representative Bruce Braley joins us live. What are your questions for Congressman Braley? 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and the first part of this year we've been checking in with our elected representatives in Washington at the beginning of the new Congress. A couple weeks back, you may remember we had a discussion with Representative King and also Senator Grassley on a program. Today it's was the turn of Representative Loebsack in our first half hour. Now joining us live, the U.S. Representative for Iowa's 1st Congressional District. He's been serving that district since 2007. Democrat Bruce Braley, the 1st District, lying in the northeastern part of the state. We're still getting acquainted with these new districts now that we're down to four. But the 1st District includes Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, Marshalltown, and Dubuque. Congressman Braley joining us live from Washington. So glad to have you with us, Congressman.
Thanks for having me back on the show, Ben.
I'm going to reach out to our listeners in the 20 minutes or so we have Congressman Braley. Please reach out with your questions for him. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. Also the social media, our Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk. You just stepped out of a conference, press conference, Congressman Braley. I was watching some of it online. You co-introduced legislation with Representative Spears of California that would remove the ability of military commanders to overrule courts martial in sexual assault cases. You mentioned a case several times in that press conference, one involving Air Force General Craig Franklin. Remind us of that case and what it has to do with the legislation and overall the problem of sexual assault and domestic violence in the military.
Well, I've been working on those twin issues ever since I got to Congress. We've had multiple hearings. I've had personal meetings with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Secretary of Defense, and others. I was just out at the Pentagon recently with senators and House members in both parties to get a progress update on the changes that are being made because of the alarming problem of sexual assault in the military and the abysmal conviction rates through the Uniform Code of Military Justice that's implemented in these cases. And we have received constant assurances that the Pentagon takes this problem seriously and is communicating that to commanding officers up and down the chain of command and everyone in the ranks. And yet we continue to experience these bizarre circumstances the latest being a conviction in front of a military court-martial of an Air Force lieutenant colonel named James Wilkerson, who was convicted by an all-male jury appointed by the same general who basically pardoned him after the conviction and before any appeals process had taken place and completely exonerated him of any responsibility for his involvement in the sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. And the basis that General Franklin gave for that?
Well, it's a power given to the convening authority under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to consider factors relating to the career of the accused and allow that to trump justice for the victim and the punishment that was decided after a full trial and a conviction by a jury of his peers, all of whom were male and all of whom were appointed by the same general who overturned the conviction without any further review of the case.
Mm-hmm. So your legislation that you co-introduced today would do what in such cases?
It would eliminate the discretion of the convening authority, in this case the three-star general, to basically override the judicial system in the military and impose their own sense of justice and not respect the rights of the victim of sexual assault, who was the one who was the subject of the scrutiny of this trial along with the accused. And now it's as if the trial didn't take place, as if the conviction and penalty didn't mean anything. And unlike in the civilian world where a president or a governor might issue a pardon like this, there's no accountability to the voters.
Mm-hmm. Is this one case an outlier or is something that happens again and again in the military?
No, sadly, Ben, it's not an outlier. There are numerous reported instances of this, and it's one of the reasons why it's so tough to obtain convictions in cases involving military sexual assault. Statistics show that less than 20% of the actual assaults are reported by the victims. Then of those that are reported, the ones that are referred for prosecution are a very small subset of those reported claims. And then the actual conviction rate is abysmally small based on the known numbers of sexual assault in the military.
Congressman Braley with us for another 15 minutes. We do want to get to a caller or two, some social media. So let's, if we could, move on to a couple of other issues. This before we go to our callers, Congressman. Last week, you voted with most of your Democratic colleagues voting against the Republican spending bill that would fund the government through the end of September. Now, the legislation granted the Pentagon, the Department of Veterans Affairs, some flexibility in implementing their share of these short-term spending cuts we know as the sequestration. We talked with Representative Loebsack in the first half hour. He crossed the aisle to join 52 other the bill passed. You joined the Democrats. He crossed the aisle to join the Republicans. He says the bill was flawed, but his reasons for voting were he wants to bridge this partisan divide, and he wants to move it along, prevent a government shutdown above all else. And I wondered, why didn't you vote against this
because,
vote for it? Yeah.
Well, first of all, Ben, I totally respect Congressman Loebsack's decision to vote how he felt was in the best interest of the people in the 2nd District of Iowa. And like Congressman Loebsack, I had things about this bill that I liked: increased pay for our troops, increased funding for embassy security. And I want to work together to bring a bridge to this partisan divide. That's why I voted on the end of the year deal that resolved so many of the outstanding issues that my constituents were complaining about in terms of a lack of predictability. But the problem with the continuing resolution that was passed last week is that it doesn't do anything to address the problems that we are facing right now because of a misguided sequestration system that was set up, even though every one of us in the Iowa delegation voted against the original bill that created this process. You know, I was in Cedar Rapids last weekend talking to mothers of children who in Head Start programs there. They're looking at a reduction of 62 Head Start slots. I have airports in my district in Waterloo and Dubuque that are going to be losing their control towers. And we are going to see ripple effects throughout all these federal agencies that are going to have a real and negative impact on the people that I represent. So what we need to do is we need to roll up our sleeves and address all of these problems that are outstanding. And the continuing resolution, in my opinion, while it had things that I supported, did not do enough to solve those problems.
1-866-780-9100. Let's go to callers, Congressman Braley. Nathan from Ex-Ira, if I got that correct, west of Des Moines, Ex-Ira. Nathan, are
over
you there?
Over by Audubon.
Okay.
Yep,
thank you,
there.
Congressman. Yep, Nathan, I think you had a question that fit in with our discussion at the moment very well. What is it?
Yeah, my question is that one thing that all Americans seem to agree on is that their leaders need to start working across the aisle to get things done. And so my question to the congressman was just that. What are you doing in Washington to kind of reach across party lines and bring people together?
Well, that's a great question, Nathan, and one that I've been working on ever since I got here. I tell people that one of the best places to solve that issue is down in the House gym, because down there nobody cares what party you belong to. You learn about members' families, what they did before they came to Congress. And that's why, even though I was in the minority last Congress, I was able to get three bills passed into law and signed by the president. It was because I had good working relationships with Republican colleagues who could work with me to move legislation forward. But I think it's even more basic than that. I think it starts with developing relationships of trust with the people you work with. And that's why later this week, I've invited three Republican colleagues over to my house to meet with two of my Democratic colleagues and I. And we're going to be having dinner with a CEO of one of Iowa's largest business, talking about the economy, what we can do to address some of these longstanding problems that keep Congress from solving problems, and to get the economy back on track where it needs to be. I think it may be a small step, but I think it's an important step to bring people together and create more trust among the people who are trying to solve the problems in Congress.
I think Nathan's question echoes a lot of people. I'm sure you heard it from constituents. And tired of the intransigence in Congress, the gridlock. Congressman Loebsack, last half hour, we heard talk about some legislation he introduced weeks ago that would cut members of Congress's pay by 10%, also repealing the automatic pay increases that currently take place. Is that a bill you support, Congressman Braley?
Well, I have voted to make sure that we do not get congressional pay increases. But there's an enormous amount of problems we have to address to get the budget back in order. And a lot of people focus on symbolic issues like the one you're talking about, and that gives them a justification to ignore the real problems, which is how we are going to deal with the incredible deficits that we've accumulated, how we come up with a balanced approach of revenues and targeted spending cuts, rather than the MEDAX approach we took with this sequestration system that I voted against. And until people are willing to do what Iowans did when they came to my deficit reduction town halls, that's sitting at a table with their friends and neighbors and talk about and vote for or against the very type of proposals that we deal with here in Congress, we're never going to get to the point where the American people want us to. That involves honest recognition of what the problems are and both sides being willing to give things up to make sure that we are addressing the problems in a meaningful way. And that's what I'll be focused on.
Congressman Paul Ryan introducing the latest version of a plan to balance the budget within a decade. I believe cutting what he calls Obamacare, in a sense, I guess, is generally recognized as a name that the president also uses, Obamacare, but also Medicaid and Medicare, while accepting higher income taxes. Is that something where everybody gives up something? Is that the sort of what you're talking about there, something along the lines of Paul Ryan suggesting?
Well, I don't think Congressman Ryan mentioned at all that the reason why he was able to, in his plan, attempt to balance the budget in a much more rapid time frame is because of the tax increases on the wealthiest Americans that we all agreed to at the end of the year. That was completely missing from the debate on how we get the deficit under control leading up to the last election. So I'm encouraged by the fact that the House budget chairman apparently now recognizes that that important part of the puzzle is going to help us get this problem under control. But the problem is that he serves on the Ways and Means Committee. That's the principal tax writing committee that deals with all of the entitlement programs you've just mentioned, Ben. And I would ask Congressman Ryan and everyone else who keeps talking about entitlement reform why their Ways and Means Committee didn't put forward a single bill and send it to the House floor that dealt with meaningful entitlement reform. The fact that they have failed to do that and he serves on that committee shows you that a lot of this is more about political posturing than getting to the heart of the problem. The biggest problem we faced with entitlement reform is we have runaway spending on health care in this country. And until we are serious about how we can provide incentives to people to avoid the need for the incredible amounts we spend on health care in this country through behavioral economics, you know, we're just moving pieces around and never getting to the root cause of the problem. I can tell you that I think the American people resoundingly rejected his proposal to privatize Medicare. And that's also included in this plan the way it was 2 years ago. So here we are back with the same old failed proposal.
U.S. Representative Bruce Braley of Iowa's 1st Congressional District with us for this half hour, about 10 minutes remaining. This Facebook post, Congressman, from our listener Alexander, he asks, how do you feel about campaign finance reform, and what are the real actions you're going to take to address this issue?
Well, I have long supported campaign finance reform, and unfortunately, I was the poster child of how bad campaign finance reform decisions by the Supreme Court have made this problem worse rather than better. Because after the Citizens United decision came down, I had $2.5 million of secret outside money spent against me in 2010. And as a result of that, there's been a huge escalation in secret outside spending in campaigns. And the sad reality is this problem has gotten worse since I came to Congress, not better. The Supreme Court in that decision erroneously assumed that Congress would step in and require more transparency and disclosure of who was paying for those secret donations. And we passed a bill in the House called the Disclose Act that would have done just that and addressed many of the problems of that decision. Unfortunately, they couldn't get past the filibuster in the Senate and get enough votes to get a vote on it on the Senate floor. Now, with the current makeup of Congress, the likelihood of getting meaningful campaign finance reform passed in Congress is minimal until things change. Plus, the Supreme Court is considering another case that could make things even worse. So, you know, I support efforts to try to improve campaign finance reform, but the current Supreme Court has a very serious problem with the constitutionality under their interpretation of limitations on spending in political campaigns.
A few words to the topic of immigration, if we could, before we have to say goodbye. Sunday, in the weekend, Representative Kevin McCarthy, the third highest-ranking Republican in the House, said there's enough support in the House to support and pass comprehensive immigration reform. No real details in that comment. I wonder if you felt there was enough support for comprehensive immigration reform, and if the Republicans now look like they would go along with a pathway to citizenship for undocumented workers.
Well, I think that the biggest change I've seen since the last election is there seems to be a growing awareness among my Republican colleagues that doing nothing on immigration is a recipe for more futility and more economic uncertainty. So I have long supported comprehensive immigration reform that secures the border, that provides an opportunity to do something with the millions of immigrants in this country already. And by doing that, I'm talking about getting them to admit that they broke the law, agreeing to pay a stiff fine, having to serve a period of probation that could result in their deportation if they broke their terms of their probation, and then going to the back of the line so that those who are here attempting to get into this country through official channels are going to be in front of them. But we can't ignore the fact that our economy depends very heavily on this labor force, and we have to figure out a way we can deal with it by punishing those who are exploiting this labor pool. And that has to be part of the conversation for any comprehensive solution. And I'm encouraged by the fact that this seems to be one of those issues we're actually seeing more and more consensus building toward.
And what would be, in your eyes, the biggest benefits for Iowans in the passing of some sort of comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, you know, I have people contacting my office all the time asking for action on immigration reform. And it's people as diverse as dairy farmers in northeast Iowa. It's seed corn companies who can no longer find those teenage Iowa kids who are willing to go out on a hot summer day and detassel seed corn. It's people looking to do startup businesses involving high-tech people with computer and engineering backgrounds and not being able to find a labor force in Iowa that can meet some of their needs. So those types of things that are going to be critical to the economic future of Iowa are reasons why we should at least engage in this conversation and be honest about some of the trade-offs. When I had the largest immigration raid in U.S. history at Postville, I asked ICE, the federal agency who was involved in that investigation, for details about the cost of the investigation and the deportation of people that they apprehended. And when you look at those costs and look at the number of people involved, then you start to realize that we have to come up with a solution, and that should be something that pleases people across the political spectrum.
Bruce Braley, in February, you announced you would be running for the Democratic nomination for the 2014 United States Senate election in Iowa with the announcement of Senator Harkin's retirement. You have run several successful campaigns for Iowa's 1st District in its old boundaries, and this last time in the new 1st District of Iowa. This has been eastern Iowa, notably a bluer, more liberal part of the state in voting patterns. And as a Senate candidate, I wonder how you plan to appeal to the western half of the state, the rest of the state, with overall a more conservative, redder voting history.
Well, Ben, I love Iowa. I care deeply about the future of Iowa, and I believe I can be a strong and effective champion for the people of Iowa. I have friends and family all over the state of Iowa. I've had the pleasure of working all over the state of Iowa, and Iowans are Iowans no matter where they live. They have a shared sense of values no matter which political party they belong to. They want somebody who's going to set aside partisan differences and work hard to be an effective champion for this state. I believe I have an existing track record of doing just that, of working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to pass important policy that benefits the people of Iowa, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity to discuss that with Iowans all across this state.
A quick word in the minute or so we have remaining. Drones, a topic of conversation due to that 13-hour filibuster of put on by Rand Paul, Senator Paul of Kentucky. I wonder how you see the issue. As drone technology rapidly advances in the next few years, what you see as the biggest challenges we will face in the use of perhaps civilian drones on our territory?
Well, like any new technology, it's something that needs to be closely monitored to make sure that we are achieving the appropriate balance between national security and protecting civil liberties and human rights. I have seen drone technology in its best format when I was in Afghanistan and was watching drones track suspected terrorists in Yemen and around the world at a safe distance and enhancing our intelligence capabilities. But I think Americans should be legitimately concerned about how that technology could be used for purposes that are not consistent with the Constitution. And that's why we need to do our job as oversight here in Congress and make sure that we are protecting the rights of American citizens while harnessing this technology in ways that are benefiting Americans.
Okay, Congressman Braley, thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thanks, Ben.
Congressman Bruce Braley of Iowa's 1st District joining us as we In the first part of this year, talk with our elected representatives in Washington at the beginning of the new Congress. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of this program, River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email address. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Remember, this is our spring pledge drive. It's important for you to support, let's face it, a mission and a service that you've come to depend on. Won't you please? Thank you for those who've already supported. In just a moment, you'll hear how to support Iowa Public Radio.